Assalamu alaikum. Hi. My students ask so many crazy questions, and most of them are so not related to what I taught them. Okay, however, there are some questions that are quite intelligent, and one of them would be about fever. Okay, so what is fever? Does it cause, like, you know, dangerous effect, harmful effect to us, prolonged effect? Is it good or bad? And so forth. So in today's podcast, I'm going to talk about fever. Okay, so what is fever? Fever is actually an elevated temperature of human body that is basically just beyond the normal range. The question now, what is the normal range of body temperature? So the normal range of body temperature is 36 to 37 degrees Celsius. Okay, so the reason why there's a range, because our body temperature, the normal one, fluctuates all the time, every day. And it, for instance, like before dawn, our body temperature decreases, and in the afternoon, it's going to spike up. Okay, but it's still considered as normal. But for instance, like here we in Malaysia, you know, we have, you know how hot Malaysia is. I always joke with my students, like, we have two suns in our solar system. And they're like, what, really, miss? And they actually believe me, because I'm their teacher. So teachers are never wrong, so they kind of like believe me. I was like, you guys are like total nerds, you know. And they're like, okay, fine, right? So yeah, okay, just a disclaimer, we have one sun only in our solar system. Obviously there are much more galaxies out there, but particularly our solar system, only one sun. Okay, right, back to fever. So as I said, it fluctuates all the time, and that's how we get the range, the normal range, which is from 36 degrees Celsius to 37 degrees Celsius. And the body temperature also varies slightly. It depends on where you want to measure the body temperature. So for instance, like the normal one, our doctors normally like measure body temperature by putting the thermometer in the armpit, or maybe just beneath your tongue, right? That is the oral and the armpit temperatures. Because the reason why they measure orally and from your armpit, because these areas approximate the actual body temperature, and we have to let's face it, right? It's more convenient to measure, okay, rather than doing the rectal, because rectal temperature normally they are internal temperature, and they tend to be a bit more higher than the skin. Okay, right, so why do we have fever? So we already talked about what is fever. It's basically just elevation of body temperature than the normal one. So what caused it? Okay, what caused it? So most of the time, fever is present in related to the stimulation of the body's immune response. So basically, right, the reason why we have fever most of the time is actually because it's just showing that our immune system is working really, really well. So there is probably a viral infection or bacterial infection, and our immune system is trying to fight all of these pathogens. Okay, pathogens are basically microscopic organisms that cause diseases to us, right? So these infectious agents, so in order to gain an upper hand, so fever is triggered so that it can support our immune system, weakening these pathogens, make our body environment to be less favorable as a host, okay, so that these viruses, bacteria, they wouldn't be able to survive. So for information, most bacteria and virus, they aren't able to replicate and proliferate well at high temperature. And this is the same with our body cells. So our body cells, so they don't work well at high temperature. But if you were to make a decision between dealing with virus and bacteria and having your body cells to not be able to work properly, we would rather have our body cells not working properly at high temperature rather than dealing with bacteria and viral infection, because there's millions of bacteria and viruses out there, and most of the time it takes time to deal with them, and sometimes we lose. Okay, most of the time we win, but sometimes we lose, and we're not going to take that chance. Okay, so, and the good thing about even that, you know, when your body cells are not working well at high temperature, our body temperature will go back to normal, and there's time for the body cells to recover and retain its normal effective function, okay, cellular function. So basically, by having fever, it's gonna prevent the virus to replicate, and therefore they cannot survive because most of them are temperature sensitive. Okay, but again, even though that's the usual cases, but there are other cases that can lead to fever. And for instance, we have like drug abuse, like amphetamine abuse, or maybe like a symptom of alcohol withdrawals, right? So alcohol withdrawals and drug abuse, they can both elicit fever. Okay, and besides that, we also have environmental favors. You know, like for instance, you are crazy about suntanning and you bake yourself under the sun for hours and hours, and this is going to, you know, you're gonna get heat stroke, and that is actually environmental fever. Okay, and there are also other illnesses that you know, cause you to have fever as well. Okay, so basically in your body or in your brain, okay, there's the part of your brain we call it as hypothalamus. That's it, basically there's thermostat in our body, right? So obviously the control center for body temperature. So hypothalamus can be triggered by some this biochemical substance. We call it as pyrogen, pyrogens. If you want to Google it, go and Google it. Okay, it's gonna squeeze your brain juice to understand about pyrogen, but enough to know that it's a biochemical substance that can basically just stimulate our hypothalamus. So hypothalamus, its job is to maintain our body temperature within the normal range, 36 to 37 degrees Celsius. However, if pyrogens are present in our blood system, then it's gonna trigger hypothalamus. Okay, so our body cell can produce pyrogens and many pathogens. Okay, the bad bacteria and virus, they also produce pathogens. Sorry, they also produce pyrogens. Okay, so when there is a pyrogen, okay, when there's pyrogens in our blood system, it goes to the hypothalamus, and hypothalamus, our biological thermostat, it detects the presence of pyrogens. So it will tell our body to start to generate, okay, and retain more heat. Okay, so because they know that pyrogen comes from pathogens, so we need to do something. We need to support our immune system, weakening them. We have to weaken them, and to do so, we have to, you know, turn our body environment to become less hospitable for these viruses and bacteria. So that's why our body start to generate heat. Okay, so one way is to generate heat is, that's why before you know, when you're having fever, you start to shiver, right? So you feel cold, you feel like very chilly, you feel chilly and all that. And the reason why you feel chilly is so that your body start to shiver. So when you shiver, the muscle movement, a rapid contraction and relaxation of your muscles, is going to produce heat, more heat, excess heat. So this excess heat will lead to you know, elevated body temperature more than the normal range. Therefore, you will have fever. Okay. So the question is, children. Let's talk about children. So children typically will get higher and quicker fever compared to us adults, and this is because their immune system is inexperienced. Basically, they don't encounter much infection compared to us adults. We are old schools. We already gone through, like, you know, the hurdles of life. Okay, so many things we have already encountered. So basically, our immune system are pretty much trained. We are like the, you know, the sergeant level, and they're just like, we are the generals, and they're like, you know, the lower guy, the interns and all that. So yeah, they are very fresh, so they don't have much experience. Therefore, it's really hard for them to, you know, they're still in try and error phase. So that's why when their hypothalamus detects the pyrogens, they actually get the dramatic effect of the pyrogen, the full effect of pyrogens. Yes, and that's why they get fever, quite high fever, and they get the fever very quickly, because the effect of pyrogen is just like full force. Okay, because of the inexperience of the system. But over time, obviously, kids, children, they grew up. When they don't just grow up, their body, their immune system also grow experience as well. Okay, so what else about fever that we can talk about? Okay, should we eat more or less? So when every time we have fever, trust me, Okay, not okay. Don't trust me. I think most of us, we have fever. We have had fever. So most of the time when we have fever, we lose our appetite, right? So yeah, fit a cold, starve a fever. So they say that you know, when you eat nothing during fever or eat less, it basically can, you know, stop the fever and all that. So firstly, when you have a fever, like I said, our body function, they don't work really well at high temperature. So during fever, body functions are basically just are occurring, you know, with the body functions are occurring when in a condition where there's a physiological stress, you know, because at high temperature, our body cells aren't working really good. So there's stress, there's this physiological stress. So provoking digestion during this physiological stress, okay, it will like, oh, it was, how do I say this? It will stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system when their sympathetic nervous system is already active. So it means that you are like adding more stress, adding more physiological stress, okay? So secondly, it's possible that the body could misinterpret whatever things that, you know, enter your stomach as allergens, okay, during fever. So that's why, you know, that's the cause why we tend to lose our appetite, because, you know, the body is now focusing their energy, expanding their energy, everything in fighting the infection, for instance. And then on top of that, the body cells aren't working well at high temperature to compensate, you know, in turning the body into less favorable for the virus until the virus are killed. And then we have to like be patient with our body cells aren't working well, and that's why we're feeling fatigued, feeling very sickly and all that, because the body tissue isn't working really well at high temperature. So it's not just the virus and bacteria are affected, we ourselves are affected, but it's only temporary, alhamdulillah, it's only temporary. And the reason why we can't eat really well is because, yeah, there's a possibility where the body misinterpret whatever things that we eat, it thought of it as an allergen, right? So that's why people tend to vomit and all that. Okay, so excessive fever in rare occasion, if you have like severe fever, it can actually lead to seizure, and people can actually collapse. And what are the things, complicated things? And if that happens, yeah, you have to seek immediate medical attention. Okay, so fever is good. The normal one, the normal fever is good. Temporary normal one is good as it helps our body in fighting infection. But sometimes if it spikes too high, okay, it's actually not good, because if it's more than like high fever, like 39 above, so this can actually make our body body cells are not just working well, we are actually putting too much stress, that because our body cells and tissues, they are most of them are protein based, meaning they're made of protein. So when the heat is too much, when the body temperature is too high, so it can actually denature the proteins, right? Denature means here basically we just turn our protein to become dysfunction, okay? So body not just proteins, body fats as well, so they will basically become useless. We don't want our proteins to denature, because we are protein creatures, our body cells are all made out of proteins, so we don't want that to happen. The hormones, the enzymes, all are proteins based, right? So the integrity and the function of the proteins, they are accustomed to the normal range of body temperature. So when we are having high fever, so we're gonna cause so much complications, like so many complications like cellular stress, infarction, necrosis, seizures, delirium. So of course all kinds of complications will follow, okay? You know, whenever you have high fever. Alright, so that's why there is actually a receptor that try to maintain the limitation of high fever. And of course our body will have limitations as well. And if you see that yourself is having high fever, and after you already taken your medication like Panadol or something, and it gets worse, then please seek medical attention immediately. Okay, so in times of COVID, right, so now that we have COVID around the globe, So how do you differentiate them from the normal ones? Okay, so obviously you have to know the other symptoms of COVID-19. So if a person has a fever along with a dry cough, so they may have symptoms of COVID-19. So please look up the website of CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Preventions. So they've got so very crucial information, okay? Very educate they educate people basically on their website about these symptoms. They urge people with these symptoms to be precaution, like basically just take note, okay, what are the symptoms of COVID-19. So if you have a fever but it's not with the dry cough, okay, then it could be the normal one. But if you're concerned, then yeah, seek medical advice or attention immediately. Okay, so that's all about fever. So I hope you guys understand. So perhaps in another podcast you can talk about can fish have a fever. So I talk about this with my students and they actually gone nuts, okay, about can fish have a fever. Yeah, I will talk about that inshallah later in another podcast. Okay, thank you. Take care. Assalamualaikum. Okay, assalamualaikum. Hello, everybody. So, as promised, I'm gonna answer the question: can a fish have a fever? It sounds so unrealistic and so far-fetched, but that question is actually pretty legit. When I was in my degree, okay, so my physiology lecturer, she actually asked us the whole this question. Can the fish have a fever? And all of us, like 100 of us, we were like, what, is she for real? A fish fever? And we were like, you know, we took it as a joke. But now that I'm much more wiser and mature, like, so yeah, it's true. Can a fish have a fever? Yes, fish can have a fever. It's a legit thing, it's a real deal. Okay, so the next question would be, how and why does a fish have a fever? So first and foremost, we already discussed in the previous podcast, is that fever is actually a condition where it's pretty much a defensive mechanism. It's a key defensive mechanism. It's a key defensive mechanism for us in order to combat diseases, right? So what interesting is that it's not just found in us human and the rest of the mammals. You can also actually recognize fever condition in cold-blooded organisms. So this is a tricky part: cold-blooded and us mammals, which are warm-blooded. So what in the world are those things? Okay, so in a nutshell, cold-blooded organism or animals, they are basically their body temperature resemble or follow the external environment temperature, right? So they tend to follow the environment temperature. That is what we call as cold-blooded. Okay, so cold-blooded organisms, and most of the time reptiles. Okay, so these are example of cold-blooded animals. Warm-blooded animals like us, and also mammals, other mammals, we are considered as warm-blooded animals because we try our best to retain the body temperature. Even the external environment temperature fluctuates. So if it gets too cold, like in winter, in summer it gets too hot, our body temperature remains the same within the normal range. Okay, our body will try our best. Will try its best to remain, okay, maintain the body temperature at optimum level. That is basically, in a nutshell, what is warm-blooded and cold-blooded. So it's pretty common for the warm-blooded animals to have fever because it's, like I say, it's a key defensive mechanism to support our immune system. But for the cold-blooded animals, that's pretty, you know, really, you know, you're gonna have like this, really? Are you sure? Yeah, I'm pretty sure, because the fever is not like exactly the same like the fever that we have. Is their fever is called behavioral fever. Okay, so it's pretty interesting actually. So as you know, fever is basically an elevation of body temperature, and what I did not talk about in the previous podcast is that it's actually resulted from default or basically just the default action of immune response, which is inflammation. So inflammation response is actually the immediate automatic immune response triggered, you know, whenever you have some things that provoking it. Like for instance, if there's a bacteria able to penetrate in your skin, then the first
line of response would be, the first line of response would be inflammation, right? And even if you, for example, if you stub your toe, right, to the chair or to the desk or something, to the table, to the corner of the table, you tap your toe, there's no wound, there's no cut, there's no bleeding, but still you're gonna see that your toe start to swell, inflame, and that is actually inflammation going on. And the reason why inflammation is the first thing that your immune system triggers is because it increases the localized area, increases the temperature of the localized area, just in case if there's a bacteria or pathogens there, is, and most of them are pretty much temperature sensitive, it's gonna kill them. Okay, that's the reason why inflammation response is always the first thing that is triggered. Okay, right, so basically there's, if there's bacteria, viral infection, inflammation response will always be triggered. Okay, so so I give you a, let me paint you an example. So let's say you have a paper cut, so a pathogen enters your skin, right, penetrate your skin into your body tissue, into this beneath tissue, right, the connective tissue, the tissue beneath the skin. So what happens is that our immune cells, okay, we call it we call them as leukocytes, so they will produce this chemical messenger, okay, that will basically you know, like they basically just stimulate cell trafficking. What it means by cell trafficking is that it's going to stimulate other immune cells to come, you know, to gather at the injury site and start to, you know, like berjemaah and kill the pathogen, basically just fight off the pathogen, right? So some of the chemical signals or chemical messengers are called cytokines. Cytokines are basically the proteins that will regulate the activity of the immune cells fighting the infection. So these cytokines are responsible in inducing or inducting the fever. Okay, so one example of cytokines would be TNF, tumor necrosis factor. So this type of cytokine is often found in all kinds of animals, doesn't matter cold-blooded or warm-blooded, right? So particularly for fish, let's go back to behavioral fever that fish have. So fish are cold-blooded animals, and most of the time their body temperature very closely follow the external environment temperature, where the water, right, the water where they live, okay, their body temperature will follow the temperature of the water or the environment. Okay, so similarly with other cold-blooded animals like reptiles, amphibians like frogs or something. So what happens is that for fish, when they are infected with the bacteria or a pathogen, so they are going to basically utilizing this ability, this cold-blooded feature, they're going to utilize that, whereby you know, they're going to migrate to warmer places every time they are infected with pathogen. Okay, so this will lead to this behavior fever that we talked about just now, which explain why fish can have a fever. Okay, so by you know, when they, because the feature, the characteristic of cold-blooded animals, that they follow the environment temperature. So what happens to these fish is that when they are infected with a pathogen, they will migrate to a place, to another place that is warmer than their original place. Okay, because when they migrate to the warmer place, they know that their body temperature will spike following the external environment, following the temperature of the water that they have migrated to, right? So this can increase their body temperature, therefore producing fever. And that's what we call as behavioral fever, because they basically behave. The migration is a type of behavior, animal behavior, okay? So this increase their body temperature by its behavior. So the raised temperature will allow more effective defensive measures, okay, basically supporting their body immune system, okay, to fight off the pathogen. And obviously, as we talked about in the previous podcast, where bacteria and viruses or pathogens, most of the time they are unable to divide or multiply or proliferate at high temperature, so the rate of multiplication just drop, okay, and weakening them, therefore make it more effective for the immune system to fight off the pathogens. Okay, so although fever is a very important fighting diseases, okay, but basically there's not much knowledge in regards of behavioral fever. There's still ongoing research that scientists, researchers, you know, they are still doing you know, studies on behavioral fever, but what they found is they studied the carps, the infected with this herpivirus. So they actually observed that this fish actually migrate to you know, they are fairly moving, so they move to the area of a warmer area of warmer areas basically, and that's how they actually and they measure their temperature, and they found that their body temperature increases and they actually survive, okay, the infection, which is something that is impossible if they stay at the original place, which is cooler than the warmer area. Okay, so yeah, that's it. Can fish have fever? Yes. Can fish have a fever? Yes, they can. They can have a fever, and how and why, I already explained. All right. Okay, that's it. If you have any other questions, please just shoot me with those questions. Bombard me with all those questions. I will try my best to answer them. Thank you. Take care. Hello, hi, assalamualaikum. Okay, so I realized the previous podcasts were really, really basically just unlistenable. Okay, so I hope this one you guys can listen it. Okay, so today's topic I want to talk about is about evolution. Okay, so what is evolution? So when I was younger, or not just younger, I think like a couple years ago, until a couple years ago, I really have this strong disagreement, right, for evolution. So every time I heard this word evolution, what came to mind was the Darwin theory, right? So obviously the notion was man derived from apes. That's it. Okay, and of course, as a Muslim, right, so I disagree with the notion that human beings were basically evolved from apes, because as we know, the first human being created was Adam alayhi salam. So that is actually my strongest argument, the reason why I strongly disagree with the notion. Right, so however, I cannot deny the concept of evolution for other species. I mean, like, obviously evolution and adaptation, they are super related. It's very hard to differentiate between evolution and adaptation because they basically coexist together. So what is adaptation? What is evolution? So adaptation is basically when we adapt to changing environment, right? So for instance, let's give an example. We are Malaysians, so we are accustomed to very hot weather and raining, right? So I've never been to four season countries, but for people who've been there, I'm sure you guys can relate this. So you're really accustomed to Malaysian weather, but then when you go to, for instance, you go to Korea or you go to London, especially during like during winter or, you know, fall, where it's pretty cold, right? You adapt, you feel the cold, probably much colder than the Londoners or the Korean people, because they already accustomed to their weather. So the coldness that they feel isn't as badly as you are feeling, correct? It's because you're new to it, okay? You've never experienced it before, so it's very novel to you. So the harshness of the cold really affecting you, right? So, but then a day or two later, you start to adapt to the weather, right? So maybe first few days, your nose turn red, right? You sneeze like crazy, all this flea comes out, right? But then maybe a week later, you become accustomed to it. You adapt it to the weather. So that is adaptation, meaning your body make some changes to accommodate to the changing environment, right? That is adaptation. Evolution, right, is when it's almost like adaptation, but we apply adaptation for a longer period of time, right? So it takes like years, hundreds of millions of years, right? So for instance, like, what can I say about evolution? Okay, let's say there were animals that, you know, we know that, you know, scientists came out with these studies show that Earth before, previously, the Earth wasn't as it is today, right? Earth, meaning that the land once were together, right? So meaning that right now we have all these, you know, Australia, what do you call, we have all these different continents, right? Yeah, I forgot the word, Benua is continent. Okay, so you have all these different continents. You have the Australian continent, you have the African, you have the America, you have Asia, right? So you have the Middle East and all that. Is it a continent? Okay, so yeah, but before that, we don't have this continent, right? So imagine the animals or the organisms that used to live in these, I think it's called, is it Eurasia, right? I think previously, before the Earth start to, you know, undergone this process, because is it platonic? Okay, you know, it means that the not platonic, let me just, okay, not platonic, what do we call it, the movement, the earth plate movement, we call it as plate tectonic, yes, right? So this plate tectonic is the reason why the surface of the earth, you know, we basically are living in the crust of the earth. So these plates of the earth just move because of the inside, because when we remember we learned science where, you know, like, I can imagine when we cut, if we were able to cut the earth open, you know, like we cut oranges or avocado, right? You can see the inside, you have the seed and all these layers and layers of flesh. Similarly with the earth, so the inner part, you have the core, you have the inner crust, you have the inner core, and then you have the outer core, right? You have the mantle, which is the inner part, the innermost part, the mantle, and then you have the inner core, outer core, and then you have the crust. So we are living on the crust, okay? So the crust is where the plates are, and of course the mantle, the inside of the earth, the inner core, is like thousands of degrees Celsius. It's super super hot, and it's basically fluid. It has actually boiling water in it, so they actually move, right? So they're very hot. So, and we know science, we know physics, where, you know, when there's when you apply heat, the atoms will move like crazy. So of course every time you have heat, you apply kinetic energy, and kinetic energy will cause something to move like crazy, right? Every time you move, you are actually exhibiting a kinetic energy. So similarly, so this energy from the heat, superheated core, caused these plate tectonic movement, right? And eventually caused the Eurasia to become what we have today. Okay, so this is basic. I don't have deep knowledge about this. This is more on geoscience, and I'm not the expert on geoscience, but this continental drift is real thing. Okay, back to the first creation. Okay, so what I want to say is about evolution is that imagine during the Eurasia, so you have this organism, they are all together in the same place, in the same land, and I'm thinking probably they have, you know, if not different, maybe slightly different weather or climate, so they are accustomed to almost similar like weather, like, okay. But then when the continental drift occurred, the plate tectonic movement occurred, and then you have all these lands, they start to drift away further apart from each other, separated, and when they're separated, they went to different parts of the earth, higher latitude, lower latitude, right? So you have the other side of the longitudinal part, nearing the equator. So if you're nearing the equator, this is the weather. And of course, I think I have to rephrase back about the Eurasian part just now, when I say that they have almost similar weather. Not necessarily, even though they are like connected, but if you see, they're like this huge land, but even though there's huge land, they're connected, but some the middle part of them probably are at, were the middle part was at maybe was at the equator, the northern part, the northern part, right? So they have different climates, but the different would be that they are connect, they were connected. So, but then continental drift occurred, these plate tectonics occurred, so these organisms were all scattered, they were dispersed, and basically they were different now, you know, obviously different, they no longer the same, right? So they have to adapt, and of course I'm guessing many of them die because of these sudden, I don't think sudden, but you know, maybe some of them die, not be able to adapt, but I would argue that most of them survive because the movement or the continental drift, it didn't occur like suddenly, you know, like one day is Eurasia, the next day is like all these continents appeared. No, it took time, slowly and slowly, for the plates to move and all that. So obviously the organism will be were able to face the changing, because the changes occurred slowly. You know, when you want to change, slowly change is good, but if you abruptly change, you're gonna have heart attack, you know, like that's when you want to give a news, you don't give a sudden news to someone, you slowly you know, let go of the steam, right? Let them be how do I say this, acquainted with the environment that's slowly changing it, right? If you want to change your house, if you change abruptly, your husband going to notice, or your wife is going to notice, but if you change gradually, people won't be able to notice it. All right, I'm not teaching you how to have an affair. No, don't do that, please. Okay, so that is evolution. Evolution is when an organism basically adapted to changing environment to the level that their genetic makeup change. Okay, the major difference between adaptation and evolution is that adaptation is you change your behavior, for instance, right? Like I give example just now, where you have these Malaysian weather, you have London weather. So what would you do to adapt to London's weather, or when these London people came to Malaysia, what do they do in order to adapt to the Malaysian weather? So they won't be able to, obviously, when you come to Malaysia, would you wear 3 layers of clothing? Obviously no. You can look at these white people, they start to wear like singlet, right, or bikini, I don't know. Okay, maybe they don't wear bikini, but their clothing, just a layer of clothing. But when we go to their place, especially during winter season, we have to wear layers and layers of clothing. So that is adaptation. We change our routine, or we change our behavior, okay? That's adaptation. So, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to last longer. But evolution is when the adaptation is practiced for a long period to the level that you get really accustomed to it, and your genetic makeup change because of it. In order to adapt to the changing environment, to survive and reproduce, it's crucial to change the genetic makeup, because impossible if you just change the behavior. You have to change the genetic makeup so that your body features will change too, therefore helping you to adapt and survive better in the changed environment. Okay, so that is what it means by evolution. So that kind of meaning or definition I can accept 100%. Okay, because it already shown that many species had undergone evolution, where their genes actually change, so they become new subspecies. In order to, they are still the same species or the same family or genus, but you know, you have different subspecies, something like that. Like for instance, you have tigers, panthera, tigris, But then you have Pantera Tigris, you have Pantera Tigris Malayensis or Pantera Tigris Jacksony, you have Pantera Tigris, what else? The Chinese one, okay, the Indo-Chinese, I forgot what are those scientific names, what are their scientific names, right? So yeah, you have about 6 or 7, I think we have 8 subspecies of tigers, 3 of them already extinct, so we have about 5, maybe 2 of them extinct, so we have about 6 living subspecies of tigers, okay? And if you look at them, they look like, oh, they're just the same, but you can find minor changes. Probably we may not be able to identify the morphological change between these subspecies, but if you dissect or you go deeper, you go and check their DNA, their mitochondrial DNA or whatever, and you're gonna see, oh, it's different from the other conspecific, right? Or the other species, or the other member. They're both tigers, but this one is the Bengali tigers and this one is Malayan tiger, and they may look the same, probably the size is different. Bengali is more bigger than the Malaysian, even the people also, but both of them have the stripes and the orange coating, right? But then when we take their DNA sample and we check, they are actually different. So that's what it means by evolution. Okay, they evolve to become different species, but they're still tigers, understand? They're still the same species, but different, maybe subspecies or what. So the kind of evolution I can accept. But to say that human beings, Homo sapiens, come from apes, that is something that I cannot accept, alright? Because you're talking about two distinctly different species. Okay, let's not, I know maybe some arguments say that, okay, I agree that the scientists found is actually reported in studies that humans and chimps or the chimpanzees, we have about 99% similarities our DNA, but do not ignore the 1%. The 1% makes everything different, okay? So the 1% makes us human, another different, distinctly different species than the chimps, right? So we do all kinds of amazing stuff where chimps can't do. We make computers, we make rockets too. Right now they are launching these rockets to Mars. We make vaccines. We have doctors, we have civilizations, we make buildings. Look at chimps, what do? Right? the most brilliant thing that they do is that they copy others how to break open a seed, right? How to cut open a fruit or something, right? That's the best thing that they can do. They don't know how to read, they don't know how to make a language. We humans even create a language. I've even learned, if you guys read The Lord of the Ring, Tolkien's, right? So he actually created multiple languages in his book. So you have the Elvish language, you have these dwarf language, right? So I actually learned the Elvish language. I memorized and understood the format of the writings. It's almost like Korean and Jawi a little bit. Yeah, I even, of course, you asked me to do it, I forgot already. Language, you have to practice. I don't remember it anymore, but yeah, I've learned it actually. That's how amazing human beings are, and to degrade us to the chimps level, that is utterly unacceptable. So, and of course, I have to incorporate my Muslim faith, because we cannot detach our faith, our religion, from science, from knowledge, because religion is knowledge. Even in the Quran is full with knowledge. Allah teaches knowledge in the Quran. Quran is a book of knowledge, it's a book of guidance, it's a manual book for to live, right? It's basically a map to this journey, right, to meet our creator. So we cannot extract, or how do I say this, separate the knowledge from the Quran. They are together, they are they coexist, they cannot live without one another. So it's part of the guidance, knowledge is part of the guidance. And even we already know at the first revelation Allah sent to Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is read is actually the form of knowledge. And Allah talk about himself in Surah Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahman, Alam Al-Quran, Ar-Rahman, Allah the most merciful, the most loving, the most caring, Alam Al-Quran, he's the one who taught the Quran, he taught the Quran. When he claimed himself to taught the Quran, means that he was the teacher, he is the teacher, so he teaches Quran, right? So yeah, and Allah even talk about the creation, the Genesis in Quran, right? So in Bible, biblical stories talk about, even in Christianity theology, right? So they even talk about Genesis, the first creation, and they believe that Adam alayhi salam is the first creation. So it's really bizarre how some of these Christian scientists, they believe in evolution in regards of how humans are created, or this theory where human beings come from apes. But at the same time, they believe in Christianity, that talk about how Adam alayhi salam was the first man created. It's contradiction, right? It's a contradiction. So it's really, really bizarre. So this is my argument about evolution and adaptation, and of course my belief in evolution, and how I believe evolution, which part of it is which part of it makes sense and which part of it doesn't make sense. This is my personal own view, but I don't make an argument, or I don't make my own belief just based on emotional or only one side of belief system, like only relying on my religion view, or only rely on my science background. Oh, no. So I incorporated these two forms, and that's how I came to this conclusion. So if you guys still if you still don't understand what I'm talking about, evolution adaptation, perhaps you can Google it, okay? Find the more accurate definition of evolution and adaptation. You can read about theory of Darwin, it's okay, some parts of it are true and some part of it is ambiguous, and some part of it is definitely not true. So you can extract the true points, apply in your life, and the not true one, just ignore it, right? So yeah, we have to weigh the pros and the cons and make decision which one will be beneficial to us. Okay, thank you for listening. We'll talk about another topic later, okay, in the next session. Assalamualaikum, take care. Hi there, assalamualaikum. In this session we are going to talk about vaccines. Okay, so I have been really like in a cave. I didn't read anything about the vaccines, the COVID-19 vaccine and the reactions. So I didn't check out my social media or anything at all, because I was focusing on writing my proposal. So I was like really just outcasting myself right from the world, from the real life. But then I saw my friends, my ex-colleagues, they were talking about these vaccines in the WhatsApp group, and most of them they are not from the science background. So as they were asking about vaccines, what are the side effects and all that, so I thought that perhaps it's time to talk about it. Okay, so firstly, there are many misconceptions about vaccines. I don't know why, but Malaysians are so scared of vaccines. They have this stigma of the negative effect of vaccines, that vaccines are really, really bad. You know, like a couple years back, we have these young parents, they refuse to have their newborns or their babies to be vaccinated because they form this like anti-vaccine movement and all that. So it's crazy how passionate they are in in supporting this notion or this idea of, you know, hating vaccine or
you know, like thinking vaccines are bad. So first and foremost, if you don't know something, go and do research, learn about it, right? You don't make judgment when you don't know something. Learn about it, right? You don't ignore it and then come to a conclusion. For instance, you see something flying right in your house, and if you simply look at it and then your crazy mind, okay, your crazy stupid mind, okay, already, you know, corrupted with this superstitious belief and all that, you saw something flying and then, oh my god, somebody sent a gene or something into my house, we have to visit the, you know, sorcerer or something to get rid of it. That is crazy, okay? First and foremost, if you learn biology, okay, or if you don't learn biology, if you take picture of it and you start to Google it up, maybe nowadays you can actually post the picture in Google, right, and they can find the information you want from the picture that you posted. So it's very easy. Or if you can Google it, it's at your fingertips. So, and then you realize, oh, it's not a gene or something, it's actually just a kind of fly, okay, that just wandering around because outside is very heat, very hot, so they come inside a bit cooler. So that's it, okay, it's harmless, right? Okay, now back to vaccine. Okay, I always try to be somewhere. Yeah, my students, they used to talk about this, like Miss Farah always, you know, tekandas, never mind that. Okay, now let's talk about vaccine. So what are actually vaccines? Okay, so this is the real questions. What is vaccine? So vaccines are actually, let's say, I want to talk about bacteria first, right? So let's say you have bacteria that cause disease. We call it as pathogenic bacteria. Every time you hear this word pathogen, it means microorganisms that can cause diseases, which are harmful, basically. So you have pathogenic virus, pathogenic bacteria, pathogenic nematodes or worms, right? So you have this pathogenic bacteria that can cause disease, like Staphylococcus pneumoniae and all that. So so these bacteria are harmful, right? So what happened is that, for instance, this is an example. So we weaken or we kill this bacteria. Let's say we kill it the quickest way, right? So we kill this bacteria that cause disease, right? For instance, Staphylococcus pneumoniae, okay? Is it, we have vaccine for it? I'm not sure. Okay, so this is just a silly example just to make you understand, right? Okay, so okay, and then we kill the bacteria, not just the Staphylococcus, any bacteria like cause disease, and then the dead bacteria, we use it, okay, to as a vaccine. Of course, there are many procedures going on. So what happens is that we take these dead body, dead fragments of bacteria, this dead bacteria, and we introduce it to our immune system. Basically, we inject it in our body. So when you inject, basically it goes through your blood system, and the moment something goes into your body, immediately your immune system will be alerted, right? Your immune system, your immune system is super, or how do I say, they are hypersensitive, okay? They are like really suspicious policemen. Like, they are not corrupted, they never take bribe, they are super alert, they love you like obsessed with you. So every second, every breath you take, they are always on the ready. So everything that goes into your body, they know, right? They have, like, there are spies everywhere. So when something go through your skin, basically the barrier, so when something managed to breach this barrier, so the blood immune system, okay, will be alerted, so they know that something has entered the body. So when they're alerted, they start to gather their manpower, you know, they start to, okay, all these bloods, all these immune cells, they are always in the body patrolling and all that, but they are inactive, you understand? They are there, but they are inactive, you know, like sitting until, you know, you're watching TV, like doing nothing, until your kids come with muddy clothes and they start to running in the house. So you're like, you were inactive, but then you saw your kid just running with muddy clothes, you know, all your floor are all muddy, so you become active, right? You start screaming then in, what the hell, right? So then you become active, same like these immune cells, right? So they were inactive, but when there's an intruder, so they will activate, they will be activated, okay? So similarly, so when we introduce these dead bacteria, even though it's dead, is already died, right? It's already dead. So it's died already. So it's that body of bacteria, even though it's dead, but it's still a foreign substance. It's a foreign body. So anything that is foreign, stranger, when you introduce it into the body, immune system will be alerted. You understand? Okay. So that's why that is vaccine. Vaccine is literally just like a training session for our immune system. So of course, when you have dead bacteria, it won't cause you any harm, but because it's a foreign body, it's going to activate your immune system as if, okay, the bacteria is still alive, as if it was still alive, right? It wasn't alive, it's already dead, but the immune system didn't know that, because the by default reaction is that they have to attack or they have to defend. Like inflammation, that is like the reflex reaction that our immune system have to do, regardless whether it's pathogenic or not. As long as something strange, odd, weird, foreign body goes into your body, the first line or the first thing that they do is that they will be alerted and they will start to defend themselves and start to attack. Okay, that's they do before they realize, oh, it's actually harmless. And that's why sometimes we have these unnecessary reaction of immune system, for example, like sneezing, like allergy reactions, right? So like I have allergy reaction, I can't take I love seafood, I have no problem eating seafood, all this stuff, but suddenly now I have my allergy to some of the seafood, not all, okay, not all, but just one of them. So if I eat that and I start to have these crazy rashes all over my body, right, my face will swell and all that. So yeah, suddenly I have it. So that is actually unnecessary kind of immune reaction, because the protein in the seafood actually triggers the immune system, cause my immune system to think that the protein is actually harmful, but it's not. So that's why I have this inflammation, the swelling, the inflammations are all part of the immune system reaction, okay? So back to the vaccine, as I said, it's actually like a training session for our immune system, okay? So let's talk about the COVID-19 vaccines, okay? So you have to bear in mind, COVID-19, it's a pandemic. It means that it spread globally. Everybody in this world knows about that. Knows about COVID-19. Everybody has to wear mask. It's affecting all around the world. So it's really like, when I first heard about vaccine, I was a bit suspicious as well. Like, how can you develop vaccine as quick as this? As quick as, you know, how can it be so quick to produce? To develop vaccine, it's not easy to develop vaccine. You have to go through series of trials and errors, and then you have the test probably on animals, and then clinical trials on humans. There are so many things to do, right, to consider, and then you have different kinds of vaccines. Okay, before I go deeper about COVID-19 vaccine, I want to talk about the types of vaccines. So in order to produce vaccine, you have different kinds of vaccine, depends on the person itself. So you have inactivated vaccines, you have the living inactivated vaccines means that we make this vaccine by weakening the bacteria or the pathogens, right? So we weaken these pathogens, inactivate them, basically we just kill them, like I gave example just now. So we kill these germs and then we use it, okay, to introduce into our immune system. So they don't really, because we are using dead germs, so of course the immunity will not be as strong as if we use the living one, Okay, yeah, we have several living. We actually, like I said, we have different kinds of vaccines. Let me just list them. Okay, inactivated vaccines, live attenuated vaccines, mRNA vaccines, the recombinant, the conjugate vaccine, polysaccharide subunit vaccine, tosoid vaccine, viral vector vaccine. So we have about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 6 vaccine and all that. Okay, so the inactivated one is when we use the killed germs, okay, turn it into vaccine, introduce it to body, because they're dead. So of course, the reaction of our immune system won't be as harsh. It's still a good training, but because it's dead, like, you know, like you punching, you know, when you punch a douchebag, the douchebag doesn't punch you back. It's still a good training to build up your muscle, your cardio and all that, but you don't have the skill to predict the outcomes, right? Or you can't predict the reaction from your enemies, from the opposition. Okay, that's, yeah, so it wouldn't be as good as if you have a friend or enemy to practice with, right? If you box with your friends, so you can actually, you feel the pain of getting beat up, and you get beat here, you learn the skill, when to defend, when to attack, you can find the techniques and all that, learn the techniques. So similarly with vaccines, so yeah, inactivated vaccine is good, but not as good as if you use the living one, which is the live attenuated vaccine. So normally for the inactivated vaccine, we use for like flu, you know, the influenza, okay, the shot, for the polio, rabies, hepatitis A. Those are all the kind of vaccines that use that germs or that pathogens, right? Live attenuated, the one that we use, the living one, they are alive, but don't sweat, okay, even though they're alive, but they're weakened. So when I say weaken, it means that even though they live, they are alive, but they are basically chained. Okay, they are basically chained. They can't do anything. They are so weak, they can't even attack properly, but they're still alive. Okay, they can't attack in a way that can cause you the particular disease, maybe the deadly one. But you know, like for instance, like you have smallpox, chickenpox, and all that. So these kinds of vaccine for the smallpox, chickenpox, they can actually, you can die actually from chickenpox, smallpox and all that, from rotavirus, right, rubella and all that. So by using the live one, the live attenuated one, live but weakened, okay, they will not cause the severe effect, I mean like the whole effect, like you're gonna have the smallpox or no, you're not gonna have that can cause you, that can actually kill you. But instead, you have the mild version. Okay, you may still show some symptoms, but it's controlled, right? It's curable. It can be controlled. It can be contained, right? So that's why we take this chickenpox vaccine and all that. You still get chickenpox, but it's not gonna kill you, right? It's just like a bit of rash here and there, but you're gonna get better, inshallah. Okay, and then you have the mRNA vaccines, where scientists actually work with the mRNA. What is mRNA? mRNA is the ingredient to make protein. Okay, so it's actually messenger RNA. So we get this mRNA from our own DNA. So basically, this is the new technology, I would say, and scientists actually use mRNA vaccines to develop COVID-19 vaccines. So mRNA vaccines actually, like I said, is the ingredient to make proteins, right? So scientists use this mRNA, okay, to make proteins that can trigger immune response in a human body. Okay, so it's really, really beneficial because we get mRNA from DNA. So I think I haven't read the detailed version how they make the COVID-19 vaccine, but from my knowledge, I think because mRNA, like I say, we derive mRNA from DNA, so probably they get the DNA of the virus maybe, and then they develop the process from DNA to mRNA is called transcription. So we transcribe the DNA into mRNA, and from the mRNA we produce protein to a process we call as translation. Okay, so the proteins, like I said, remember I talk about the seafood that I cannot eat, right, because it has a certain proteins that trigger my immune system. Similarly is similar with this one, right? is the same concept, right? So we use this mRNA so that it create or it makes this a certain type of protein that when introduced in our body is going to trigger or stimulate an immune response, right? So what are the benefits of using this kind of vaccine is that firstly, to develop it, it doesn't take longer time. So which explain why so fast, right? It's very, why so fast for the scientists, you know, like how quick they are to develop these vaccines. Yeah, that explains why. And then they don't use live virus, which is very risky because COVID-19 so far has killed people around the world globally. So we don't want to take risk on using live COVID virus, okay? So by using this mRNA, it basically just diminish the risk of the person who is vaccinated, who has been vaccinated, from getting COVID-19 disease, like a COVID symptoms. So yeah, so it's really, really good. The next type of vaccine would be the subunit recombinant polysaccharide and conjugate vaccine. It's like subunit and then recombinant polysaccharide conjugate. It means that there are many things that we can use as a vaccine. So subunit recombinant polysaccharide and conjugate vaccines, basically what does it mean, what are all of these things entail, is that we use a fragment of these bacteria or pathogens or germs, right? So we use a fragment of them, you know, like we, our body, we have head, hands, yeah, mata, telinga, mulut, hidung, right? Head, shoulders and legs, yeah. So we have all these body parts. So similarly with the germs, so they have their own pieces, bits and bits of them. So what happens is that in this kind of vaccine, we take some part of them, okay, that we know going to trigger our immune system. So I would argue this one would be because like all pathogen, they have this what we call as antigen. So antigen is the thing, okay, that found on the surface of the pathogen or the germ that actually trigger the production of antibody in our body. So our antibody, not antibiotic, is a different thing. Antibiotic is human made, okay, to support our immune system. Okay, it basically attacks bacteria. Antibody is substances that our immune cell, particularly we call it as B cells, okay, a type of immune cell, B lymphocytes. So B lymphocytes or B cells, they produce antibody that are complementary to the antigen that found in our body. The antigen on the bacteria or the germs, you know, when germs go into our body, on their surface they have this antigen. I always tell my students, antigen is like their identity card, like IC, you know, so they can't throw it away, it's always with them. So our immune system recognize their antigen, okay, the markers, the PMPL. I don't want to go into detail, it's very technical. Okay, but basically antigen is what triggers our B cells to produce antibody that feed the antigen. It's, they are complementary to one another. They feed like lock and key, okay? So yeah, so antigen is very, very efficient in triggering immune system. So we take that antigen from the germ and then we introduce it to human body. It's going to trigger very strong immune response, okay? So this one is really it's good as well, okay, because it's not living, we're not using living things, because for the live virus, if you use it for the live genome, it's really risky for people who already whose immune system is already hampered, okay, it's already weak, so it's not advisable to use Lavitamins. So they can actually use this kind of vaccine. So normally HPV, the human papilloma virus, okay, pneumococcal disease, meningococcal, yeah, pneumonia, yeah, like I said, the staphylococcus, yeah, they use this kind of vaccine, okay. Tosoid vaccine is when we use toxin that produced by the germs, okay, use it, because this toxin also actually can actually triggers production of antibody, so, or can also triggers immune system, yeah, so we can actually use it, okay. So for example, tetanus, okay, so you can actually, the tetanus vaccine that we take, that is actually tosoid vaccine. And you also have viral vector vaccines where For instance, this COVID-19 as well. So this the viral means that viral vector vaccine means that we actually use a modified version of a different virus, another virus, if that can cause a different kind of disease or whatever. But we use it, we modify the virus, okay, to provide protection against a particular, protection against another virus, okay. So, for instance, we have influenza virus, okay, VSV, vesicular stomatitis virus, measles virus, adenovirus. So, these virus, adenovirus, for instance, are the common the virus that cause that causes common cold, okay. So, adenovirus actually the viral vectors that we use in some COVID-19 vaccines in the clinical trials, because right now the COVID-19 vaccines that we have use the mRNA vaccines, but during the clinical trials that they did, of course, like I said, there are many kinds of vaccines that we can use, right? So of course they try and error each one of them. So one of the trials that they use is viral vector vaccines, where, you know, like grab car lah, okay, like we use somebody else's car, okay, to go to another place, like okay, for instance, I'm in Malacca, but I need someone to pick my friends, inshallah. So I call GrabCar, pick her up, and then bring her back to Malacca. You see, I don't drive it there, right? So I use another person to help grab my friend back to Malacca. So that is basically like that. So we use another virus, we modify it so that it won't cause any. Of course, this version of virus isn't going to cause a disease, so we already modify them so that it won't cause any disease, and we use it as like medium of transportation to deliver protection, basically to provide protection against what? Now we are against COVID-19, so we use it to provide protection, okay, against COVID-19, okay. So I'm not going to go detail how they do that. You're going to shut me up after this. So that's basically it. But obviously they found alhamdulillah, they found a new way by using the mRNA vaccines, and that is way better than using the viral vector or other kinds of vaccines. So I hope you understand about vaccines. Don't hate vaccines. Don't support the entire vaccine movement. It's not good. Vaccine saves life. Do you understand that? Okay, so yeah, many people back in the days, if you Google out, they actually some people who they actually died from smallpox, chickenpox, and because what? Because they are not vaccinated. Okay, and if you're vaccinated, your immune system already know what to do. They already undergone this training session, so when the real thing comes, they know what to do faster. They react faster before even the symptoms appears, right? So because sometimes when the symptoms appears, it can kill, it can become fatal, so we want to avoid that. That's why we actually vaccinated. So congratulations to those who have registered to be vaccinated. I haven't vaccinated yet, I haven't registered yet, because right now my immune system is not really okay. I'm having my own troubles, but inshallah, once I'm better, I'm going to register to be vaccinated as well. So I hope you guys, to those who haven't, go and register and get vaccinated, and those who have, congratulations, and those who supported anti-vaccine movement, now that you have listened to this, quit supporting useless things and start do something beneficial. Okay, thank you, take care, assalamualaikum. A closer look at how COVID-19 mRNA vaccines work. So right now I'm actually reading the cdc.gov coronavirus vaccines. So I'm going to summarize the articles. Maybe when you read it, you're going to understand better. Maybe you don't understand. Okay, so I'm going to summarize, hoping that you guys can understand it. Okay, so it's a little bit technical, bear with me. Okay, so like we already talked about in the previous session about these mRNA COVID-19 mRNA vaccines. So basically, the COVID-19 vaccines, they do not use live virus that caused the COVID-19. They don't use the other kinds like weaken them or killing them or take the fragment of these virus that caused COVID-19 disease. No. So what happens is that they do not use the typical or the traditional way in making vaccines. And also when people hear about mRNA, they become really really upset and also confused. And of course confusion will lead to attack, okay? Because the thing is that there are also some confusion where people thought that the mRNA vaccine will incorporate with our DNA and start to cause some mutation or whatever. So these mRNA, they will not affect or interact with our DNA in any way possible, never, okay? That's why it's really important to learn about this. What is DNA? What is RNA? Okay, and when you say that RNA is going to interact with the DNA, that's not even possible. They are two different things, and there is no way for them to actually interact unless you convert them first. So mRNA never enters the nucleus of the cell. This is something that's really crucial. This is in when you learn biology, the first chapter is about this. It's about the cell. So it's really crucial to learn about cells, because then you know the what is DNA, what is mRNA, what are their characteristics, what are their behaviors. So you understand them, and you know that would never happen, because mRNA, their behavior is that they are produced in the nucleus and they go out of the nucleus. They will not enter the nucleus. What is nucleus? For those who haven't learned science, nucleus is like an organ inside a cell. So you can imagine, you know, you have heart, you have brain, you have kidneys and all that. So nucleus is the most important, or we don't call it as organ, we call it as organelles. So it's the most important organelle in a cell. Okay, so it's where we keep our DNA. What is DNA? Deoxyribonucleic acid, very good. But what does it do? DNA is actually our blueprint. Basically, whatever the things that you are now, physically, mentally, behaviorally, right, psychologically, whatever you are now, whoever you are now, everything are encrypted in a very long sequence of DNA, of genes. So basically we are, you know, if you watch Matrix, you have this coding system. It's actually fun fact for you, that is actually a Japanese recipe, by the way. Let's go back to human being. Okay, so everything about us, they are all encrypted in this coding system. We call it as DNA. It's made out of bases, okay? Cytosine, guanine, adenine, and thymine, okay? So so that is DNA. So DNA is stored inside the nucleus, and we use DNA to make RNA. You have three types: mRNA, messenger RNA, transfer RNA, and also ribosomal RNA. So mRNA is the one that we use to make protein. So we derive mRNA from DNA. So we use our own DNA to make mRNA still inside the nucleus, and after we have made the mRNA, we take the mRNA out of the nucleus. mRNA never enters the nucleus. So to say that the RNA will corrupt our DNA or affect our DNA, that's not going to happen at all. Okay, so our DNA is really securely protected, very, very securely protected in within our nucleus. Okay, so let's talk about what happens. Okay, what is actually going to happen when you are vaccinated? So what happens is that COVID-19 mRNA vaccines, as I said, mRNA derived from DNA. So DNA is our blueprint. You can imagine DNA is like recipe. You know, when you want to cook, you have this recipe, right? Even I'm a very stupid cook. I make recipe. As lousy as I am, I have a mental recipe. Yeah, so back to here. So you have our own recipe. So to make a protein, there's also a recipe, you know, you write it down, but in this language. So we write the recipe or instructions to make protein in a form of mRNA. So you can imagine mRNA is like some kind of language, okay, that cells use in order to make the protein. So mRNA vaccine, since it contains the instruction which it gets from the DNA, because mRNA derived from DNA, right? So we use that instruction, our cells or body cells, because we introduce the mRNA, right? So cells will use this mRNA to make harmless piece of proteins, and this protein is called spike protein. The spike protein, you know, the coronavirus is called corona because corona is actually, I'm not sure whether it's Greek word or Latin words, but the meaning of corona is crown. Okay, so if you, it's very famous, right, the diagram of coronavirus. If you Google it out, you're gonna see that the diagrams of the corona, or the picture, or the morphology of the coronavirus, that they are round in shape, but then they have these spikes, right? They call it like spikes. So if you look deeper at the spikes, it looks like a crown. So that's why it gets its name from corona, crown. It means crown. So these, the crowns or the spikes that covering the surface of this coronavirus are actually made of protein. So even our cells, the surface of our cells are made of protein. We call it as phospholipid bilayer, and there's a phospholipid bilayer. So there's a lot of proteins embedded in these layers. So there are many kinds of proteins on the surface, embedded within the surface. So yeah, we are basically protein creatures, right? Yeah, back to here. So the spike is actually the proteins. Okay, the things that make up the spikes are actually proteins. So that is our aim. By using mRNA, we want to make a protein that resemble the spike. Okay, and because that spike is the one that caused the COVID-19, that's going to trigger the immune response very strongly. Okay. So COVID-19 mRNA vaccines, normally they will inject in the upper arm, right? So inject it into our blood system. So once the mRNA are inside our body, it travels to our blood system where our immune cells are, and this mRNA, okay, the vaccines which are the mRNA will go inside our immune cells, okay? Because what happens is that this mRNA will be basically like, the immune system, the great things about our immune system is that many of them are phagocytes. Phagocytes means that they just eat. They are big eaters, right? So I'm not sure about how mRNA goes inside the immune cells, because mRNA is super, super small. So it's very tiny, whether they actually go inside the cell through endocytosis, or maybe they will engulf, right? Or maybe diffusion, I'm not so sure about it. Okay, maybe you can dig deeper about it, but the thing is that one thing for sure is that the mRNA will go into the cell, our immune cells, okay, and our immune cells will use this mRNA to make protein. That's the most important thing. The fundamental concept that you need to understand is that firstly, mRNA is derived from DNA. That's the first thing. Secondly is that mRNA is used as an ingredient, the major ingredient, the main ingredient to make protein. And thirdly, the proteins that we are aiming to make or to produce is the spike proteins, which are the proteins that found on the surface of the coronavirus that caused the COVID-19 disease. That's the three concepts that you have to understand clearly. And once you grasp these three concepts, then you are able to understand whatever that I'm talking about right now. Okay, so now that the mRNA are already inside the immune cell, so these cells will use them to make protein, or the fancy word is to synthesize protein. Okay, so once this protein, the protein piece is produced, so the cell will break down whatever instructions, okay, and then get rid of them. So they destroy the mRNA basically. After they have made the proteins, they will destroy the mRNA. Next, because they already made the protein, so don't worry, so the mRNA will be gone, it will be rid of, okay. then the cell, okay, that displays the protein that they make from the mRNA that has already been destroyed, they actually will display the protein, the spike protein, on the surface. So this is what we call as the recognition. So this is like the typical way for our immune cells to activate one another. So they actually display, like, you know, like how you when you watch movie and you see how these policemen or the cops, and they always flash their badge, right? Something like that. Okay, so the immune cell flash the protein paste on its surface, show it to other immune cells, right? This is a recognition process. So they will recognize the protein as a stranger, as a foreign body. So it doesn't belong here. Like I said in previous session, anything that is stranger, that is strange, that is foreign, so it's going to trigger the immune system, right? So immune system is going to feel threatened, so they will start to, you know, defense system, start to defend and attack and all that. So once they recognize this is a foreign body, so it will stimulate the immune response. They start to build immune response, start to make antibodies, right? And the typical procedure of immune responses will be triggered. Okay, so it's like training session. Your body doesn't have coronavirus, but because of these proteins, okay, that resemble the protein spikes of the real coronavirus, so it triggers your immune system. It activates your immune system as if the real thing is there. So of course you're going to have side effects and all that, because your immune response are activated. So you're going to have this inflammation and all that. Okay, so this is a perfect training session, because it's like in other words, it's like you're lying to your immune system, make them think that they are actually in a real battle, but the thing is that they are just in the matrix. Okay, they're just like, these are all dummies. Okay, but it's good, because you see, battalions, armies, militaries, before they go to war, what they do, they have their own military session. You know, we have these I went to camp before, and we see soldiers, they actually have their training session as though they were fighting a real thing, right? So of course they have training sessions, loads of them, even medical practitioners, doctors, surgeons, before they can actually cut real people. They cut dummies first, or they cut dead people first. It's the same thing. We have to undergo trainings before we go to battle, before we go to real war. You can't go to war without any experience, without any skills. You're gonna die within seconds, right? So it's the same thing with our immune system. It's the same thing with our muscles. That's why we have to work out for our muscles. And today I didn't work out. Okay, I'm too lazy to do that. Yeah, so everything has to have training, right? If even maths, even reading, you have to train your eyes to read. Everything's all about training. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves for us to learn patience. So that's why on this earth, everything is super slow. We are impatient, but everything that Allah has created, they move slowly. You can, when you plant a seed, you don't see the tree comes out tomorrow. Not even tomorrow, maybe a week later, you see a tiny little bud comes out, right? It takes time. Everything takes time to nurture, to grow, right? So, but we humans are impatient. But Allah teaches us to undergo trainings. Even in our life, we have training, trials over trials. And most of the times we suck, right? We fail the test. But of course, you have to return back to Allah every single time also. So yeah, like I say, we cannot separate religion from knowledge. They are one, you understand? Okay, so when you learn something about science or anything at all, try to relate it to Allah. Try to relate it to your religion. Try to relate it back to the Quran, to our fitrah, to our basic, you understand? So it's really cool. Okay, when we talk about it later, I want to talk about one. Actually, just a few days back, I read Surah Nahmal. Okay, and I found a certain verse that really blows my mind away. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about that in another session. Okay, thank you so much for listening. I hope you understand and not being misjudged, no longer misjudge the vaccine, okay? Go vaccinate, and inshallah, I'm going to vaccinate too. Thank you. Assalamualaikum. Take care.